Good morning, Ms. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stacy Anderson on behalf of the District of Columbia Appellants. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Doesn't always work.
I'm going to try my best. Your Honors, the district is here to ask the court to reverse the judgment of the district court, ordering it to pay almost $1.4 million in attorney's fees in this case. Because the plain language of the district's 2009 Appropriations Act, as well as its context and legislative history, demonstrate that there's a congressional mandate that prohibits the district from paying more than $4,000 in attorney's fees in any proceeding brought under IDEA.
And plain language does that?
Your Honor, yes, that's the district's position. Congress is
that's the language that says the fees of an attorney who represents a party in an action in excess of $4,000 for that action.
And
that's
that action,
the language you're talking about.
Yes,
right?
Sir, Your Honor. Also,
that plain language would seem to say that we're dealing with that the cap applies to one attorney who represents one party in one action.
Your Honor, there's one more provision of that statute I'd like to direct the court's attention to, and that's a provision defining an IDEA proceeding, and that's defined as any action. Mm-hmm. So, Your Honor, we rely.
I understand that. I also, but I don't understand. Right. Well, that gets you anywhere.
Well, Your Honor, the district relies principally on the Dictionary Act to aid in constructing.
Yeah, so you're not talking about the plain language of the Appropriations Act. You're talking about the Appropriations Act with a supposed ambiguity and resolved by resort to the Dictionary Act.
Well, Your Honor,
but
I think
really
the dictionary.
We're past plain language. You can't win on plain language.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm not
just
saying you can win on any basis.
I understand, Your Honor. I guess I just view it slightly differently in that the Dictionary Act gives the plain meaning to the words, just like
right.
A dictionary.
Go back to the Dictionary Act.
Yes, sir.
Tell me how that creates a winner for
certainly,
you.
Certainly, Your Honor. The Dictionary Act provides that unless the context of the statute indicates otherwise, singular words are to be construed as plurals.
So you would you say that if an attorney has a client who is sues under the ADEA, or IDEA, excuse me, get my right act here, and wins, and then 2 years later they want a different reasonable compensation, and the district denies it, and they sue again, and they win again, you would say the attorney couldn't be compensated anymore if he got $4,000 the first time?
Your Honor, if it's the same cause of action, I would say no, they could only
Wait a minute. So then you're not treating action as pluralizing, right?
Your Honor,
the singular word action, you recognize that that means just one action.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that slightly because this court's.
You don't? You disagree? Then you would say that the $4,000 cap applies no matter how many actions they bring?
Your Honor, this court's construed the cap to apply to a single action
right.
In the context of an administrative proceeding right. Followed by a district
right.
Court proceeding.
So therefore,
followed by a fee on fee.
The context clearly makes it plain that action stated in the singular is to be construed in the singular, right? It doesn't cover all of the possible actions that could be brought. Just one action, right?
Related to a particular claim under IDEA. A child could have multiple different IDEA claims.
Nonetheless, counsel, you would have to agree that the word action in the Appropriations Act means one action, right?
I would agree, Your Honor.
And in the same context, how can you argue that plain language would say that attorney and party must be pluralized when action isn't? Same context.
Because, Your Honor, the context is broader than simply those words. The context also includes similar fee-shifting statutes. The Supreme Court has held that fee-shifting statutes should be construed similarly.
Have they construed any statute involving a cap?
I'm sorry?
Has the Supreme Court construed any?
No, sir. No. But
no,
they
have not. Have. So there is no parallel authority supporting you, right?
Your Honor, I would disagree with respect to that. With respect to the term an attorney and a party, which appears not only in the IDEA fee-shifting statute in the singular form, but also in 42 U.S.C. 1988, also in the singular form, those statutes without dispute apply to multi-party, multi-attorney mm-hmm. cases.
But they're a totally different context. They're not capping statutes.
No, but they are fee-shifting statutes, and the cap here operates
as... They're United States
as,
statutes, too, but as, they're not the same kind of statute that this one is. They're not a capping statute.
But the cap is on those statutes, Your Honor.
Does it really make sense if you would have to agree that if how many class members were there involved in this class action?
Your Honor, it's not defined. Thousands would be safe to say.
Would you say that you would have to agree, would you not, that if each of those thousands of class members had brought a separate action, each of those attorneys would be entitled to the $4,000?
If they
up
yes.
to the $4,000.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the district's position. As separate.
All right. Now, does it make sense to say that that would be the result under this statute, and yet if the much more judicially efficient procedure of bringing a class action for those thousands of claimants is followed, the attorney is still kept as if he were representing only one party in one action?
Yes, Your Honor. Again,
that makes sense?
It makes sense when you look at the purpose of the cap, Your Honor, which is to maximize fees available to the district.
What's the purpose of the statute? What's the purpose of the fee-shifting statute in the first place?
The purpose of a statute enacted by Congress, yes, is to encourage litigation.
Encourage the vindication of rights through
litigation. Correct. Correct, Your Honor. It is.
But we cannot take just the cap and look at the congressional purpose there to get the context.
Congress acted well aware with that purpose, Your Honor.
Right.
Congress was presented with
argument. And Congress acting with that purpose, why wouldn't the context then support the proposition that an attorney means an attorney, not, I mean, excuse me, a party means a party, not an unlimited number of parties?
Because there are very few IDEA cases in which there's actually one party, Your Honor. There are often.
I don't see why that is relevant to the question I asked you.
It's relevant, Your Honor, to the extent, again, looking at the purpose of the cap, which is to maximize.
Counsel, I have seen IDEA cases involving one party, not every year in the 23 that I've been here, but many, many times I've seen this. Don't tell me that.
No, I'm not saying that there aren't any, Your Honor. I'm
right.
saying that there are many that are not, and again, looking
at. There are many that are not, many that are.
Looking at the intent of the legislation, Your
there
Honor.
There are actually more that are one party than there are that are class actions.
And Your Honor, Congress is entitled to legislate broadly with
certainly.
A broad stroke. And in this case, it said $4,000 per proceeding. This
said
is a
$4,000 is the fees of an attorney who represents a party in an action.
And the fee shifting.
And they don't have to say, paren, we just mean what we just said, do they? In order to get us to construe it to be what they said.
Your Honor, I think we're going to have to disagree on this one because
it's clear that the drafters didn't contemplate class actions one way or the other, isn't it?
They did not.
They would never have worded it this way if they had in mind.
I don't know that that's true, Your
resolving
Honor.
Resolving the class action issue.
I don't know that that's true, Your Honor. The Congress was clearly aware of these existing class actions as reflected in the legislative history. Senator Durbin, who was an opponent of the cap, was very much aware of these existing class actions. So I would disagree with
that,
Your
Honor. Did he bring his awareness to the drafting of this?
He certainly, on the floor of the Senate, mentioned it, yes.
Now, where is it in the drafting?
In
the
drafting?
In the words of the statute.
Again, it's any proceeding, Your Honor, and that encompasses all proceedings. And this is a class action which can, beyond dispute.
But you've already admitted that proceeding, actually it's action in the terms of this statute, action is to be construed singularly.
And this is a singular action, Your Honor. Multiple plaintiffs and multiple attorneys, but
party.
A singular action.
It's party, right, that is the key thing. Represents a party. And you're insisting that that be viewed as one, although in fact there are many.
Your Honor, I'm insisting that that be read to include the word parties as well, based on the Dictionary Act and the context of other fee-shifting statutes, which also are written in the singular and apply without a doubt to class actions.
Suppose you had two families who confront substantially the same situation in the same school. And first one files, and then shortly after, the second files. And in the district court, those are assigned to the same judge, and the judge consolidates them. Let's put aside whether the consolidation would be correct or not. But at that point, it becomes one action with two clearly distinct parties under the
yes.
under any normal view. 4,000 or 8,000?
4,000, Your Honor.
4,000, really?
One action, yes, Your Honor.
Wow. Okay.
That is the district's position on the plain language of the statute. And again, in this case, if you look at the court's decision in Blackmun in 2006.
Yeah, so you cannot say it's the plain language of the statute. I understand. It may be, you make an argument based on a construction of the statute on an alleged ambiguity resolved by reference to another statute. But that it's just grating to hear you claim the plain language of the statute gives you this result.
And I'll refer to the context in the legislative
history. Okay, that's the only way you're going to get there, by context.
Context
and context
legislative
doesn't seem to be compelling.
I understand, Your Honor. again, looking at the context, the other fee-shifting statutes, as well as the legislative history, this court has construed this cap in various contexts and has consistently recognized that the purpose of the statute is to maximize the fees available for special ed, or funds available for special education.
It wasn't to maximize. If they were to maximize it, then they probably would have cut the fee to zero, right?
Maximize with, I mean,
it's a trade-off. It's a trade-off between vindicating rights and
absolutely, Your Honor,
having fees available.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And it doesn't, at least as far as I can see, it doesn't at all confront the problem of class action.
Your Honor, again, it doesn't also confront the problem of a single student who starts out with an administrative proceeding, goes to the district court, comes to this court, perhaps goes back to the district court, comes to this court again, and then goes to United States Supreme Court. A single person, a single action. Clearly, the attorney in that situation is going to generate more than $4,000 worth of fees. But the cap
very clearly confront that problem.
And it says 4,000. And it says 4,000.
Yeah.
Perhaps viewed in as an inequity, but it also says any action. And this, in my mind, encompasses that because it is a class action. And it doesn't matter, I don't think, in that case. And this court has not construed in that case that if a single student files suit with two attorneys, that they get $8,000. This court has consistently said that it's $4,000. Again, the Caseman case is an example where it was a suit for fees brought on behalf of 42 students, 52 fee petitions, $90,000 in fees. The court said the cap applies. So again, I think the district's
Which was that?
Caseman. Caseman. I can give the court site. It's a case relied on the district. 44 Fed 3rd, 637. Again, that was an action to recover fees brought on behalf of 42 children, 52 fee petitions. They were seeking $90,000 in the district court for those fees, and this court said the cap applies because those students, in their individual actions, had each collected $4,000 as part of the administrative proceeding. The case was remanded to the district court. So, again, Your Honor, Your Honors, if you look at the court's decisions, the district's strict reading of the statute is consistent with those decisions. It's consistent with the legislative intent expressed by Congress, and it's consistent with the fact that Congress chose to apply this cap to any proceeding. I see that I'm running short on time. If I may reserve the rest for rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
If my colleagues have no further questions, you can reserve. Thank you, counsel. Good morning, Mr. Rutschkoffen.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court. You don't have to get to that issue. You don't have to get to the statutory interpretation issue in this case because it was waived in this case through this court's law of the case.
Is there a single decision of this court saying that waiver or forfeiture applies when there has been
no
an opportunity to appeal that was not taken at all, so there was no prior appeal. This is a one appeal case, and yet the party that did not appeal is barred from raising an issue that theoretically was appealable before.
No.
There's
not. Is
this a case to create such a doctrine?
Well, Your Honor, we provided you half a dozen decisions from other circuits.
I understand. Those cases jumble without paying the slightest attention.
I agree.
Cases where there has been a prior appeal and cases where there is not.
Your Honor, to call this doctrine clear, and as you know, this court has had some back and forth on whether this is waiver, whether this is law of the case, and it actually speaks in collateral estoppel in some sense as well. But the one case that is most clear is ABC Inc. from the Eighth Circuit, which involves attorney's fees in subsequent orders.
Well, that's good, but what's clearest from our court?
Well, Your Honor, this court's case involved cases where there has been a prior appeal and the issue wasn't raised. But
there's a judicial economy argument there, is there not?
It
may often be more efficient for the court to address this issue in the first appeal with a cluster of other issues than to have it tucked away later and have it cause problems in the district court in the meantime. But there's no such problem here.
No, that's right. Judicial economy is only one of the issues underlying, or one of the purposes underlying this doctrine. You know, as the Eighth Circuit said in Little Earth, one of the issues is protecting the settled expectations of the parties, and there was a final appealable order here, which the plaintiffs relied on for the next 2 years in incurring attorney's fees. And
well, actually, not the next 2 years. I don't think that's correct, because I think if the dates are such that, in fact, most of the fees have been run up before the 2008 order, the fees in dispute.
Well,
here.
There was some overlap. So, Your Honor, forgive me if I've misspoken, but there certainly was a reliance interest post order in which we were incurring fees. Look, I don't want.
Is there any change in conduct on the part of counsel?
Well, certainly decisions are made based on whether or not you're going to get paid. I would think.
I don't know. Isn't that problematic in terms of counsel's obligations?
Your Honor, there are a range of reasonable decisions that attorneys can make in representing their clients, and when you're representing a client that you know that you're hitting a $4,000 fee cap, you may make different decisions. I'm not suggesting that would be the case, but all that's
involved in this sort of open up the floodgates or turn on the spigot argument is the last 6 months or something like that.
It's about 6 months. I think that's right. Your Honor, you're absolutely correct that the law of the case doctrine hasn't been applied in this context by this court.
Please, but
it's
use law of the case. Fouls up.
I don't disagree with you, but it has been discussed under the umbrella of that.
It's no need for us to do that.
I'm happy to call it waiver.
Miller call it forfeiture in this context, where there's been no prior appeal.
As I said, it really smacks of issue preclusion, but in the same case,
I don't get that at all. The idea that our court is precluded from reaching an issue because the district court resolved it one way.
I don't think it's an issue of this court being precluded. This court certainly can reach the issue if the standard is met, and the standard being clear error or manifest injustice.
No, I'm putting aside the exception.
But it's really an issue of the District of Columbia sitting on its rights. I'm not suggesting this court is hamstrung. I'm suggesting the District of Columbia is hamstrung. So I think this is a proper circumstance to apply this doctrine, and while the judicial economy issue isn't in play, there's a sense that when a party doesn't appeal at all, why should it be better off than someone who appealed and didn't raise an issue? I think that's why the doctrine should apply.
Putting aside the judicial, that's apart from that. Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? It's a big factor. Right? So,
well, I'm happy to move on to the merits, Your Honor. I bet
you would be.
Assuming that you don't prevail on your waiver forfeiture argument here, how should the court interpret this cap?
Your Honor, I think the plain language in this case certainly plays in our favor. The plain language is all in the singular. The fees of an attorney for a party, and this is a case where.
But if you really did that, would you be multiplying this $4,000 cap over all the plaintiffs? Applying this at all is what
you would say. This doesn't apply at all in a class action setting. I think, again, Judge Williams, I think you're absolutely correct that Congress clearly didn't contemplate one way or another how this would apply. What Congress what what this was a compromise provision. It was a compromise between the proponents and the opponents of the legislation, and they came up with a $4,000 number. And the proponents of the legislation on the floor of the Senate, and Judge Santel, I know you're going to yell at me about using floor statements, but
I'm getting tired of yelling about legislation.
but
the voice crying in the wilderness, I guess. Scalia and Thomas.
The proponents of the legislation on the floor of the Senate said this was designed to establish a reasonable fee, and even some of them put a number on it that you could make $300,000 a year or something like that. Yeah. Judge Brown, Senator Hutchinson said, "We're not trying to starve lawyers. We want legitimate lawyers to be able to earn a living." That was the proponents of the compromise.
She's a law school graduate, isn't she?
Your Honor, I think she's well past her practicing days. But
she's not going to be in government service.
Judge Brown, we argued below that. If you apply this literally, you're not applying it to a class action, because an attorney for a party in a proceeding is not a class action lawyer, because a class action lawyer in this case is representing 6,000 people. We're fine with that. We're fine with that construction. Obviously, it was our principal construction.
If you have any problem on language, it comes from the Dictionary Act.
Your Honor, yes. And the Dictionary Act, can't create an ambiguity, Your Honor. I mean, that's what the districts are.
We have an ambiguity before we get to the Dictionary Act.
Well, I think so. What the Supreme Court said just last year or year before last in United States versus Hayes, which I don't think we cited in our brief, Your Honor, and I apologize for that, but the case is United States versus Hayes. In footnote 5, the court says, in the rare circumstances on the rare occasions when we have relied on this rule, that is the singular equals plural rule, doing so was necessary to carry out the evident intent of the statute. That's United States versus Hayes, 129 Supreme Court, 1079, 1085, note 5. That's the most recent statement on this particular part of the Dictionary Act by the Supreme Court. And so the cap can't be read to override the evident intent of the statute. And there are a couple of other rules of construction that have to play in here. One, Judge, and I know you've addressed this before, and there's been a back and forth in this court on this, but it's that the cap has to be construed narrowly so as not to change substantive law. Now, in Caseman, Your Honor, you said that issue was set aside by a prior decision in Callaway, but in Whatley, the subsequent decision, the ping pong ball went the other way, Your Honor, and the narrow construction presumption applies because this is a permanent ban. The 2009 rule is a permanent ban on appropriations. So it really is overriding the fee award provision. And as such, it has to be construed narrowly. And the narrow construction here is the natural construction, that an attorney for a party means the singular.
But you aren't saying that if you have one kid and his parents and two lawyers, we're up to $8,000.
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that. And I think you have to look at
one kid alone and two lawyers. We're not up to
$8,000. No, that's right. It's one kid and his parents gets one fee. I think that's the natural construction.
Sort of a bit of playing with things.
Well, but it would be an absurd obstruction here to say exactly, Judge Santel, what you have said. The district has said that the evident intent of this statute is to maximize, which, as Judge Williams notes, can't be the case, but is to maximize fees, maximize education funds, even assuming it was to increase education funds. If you construed this statute as the district has suggested, what you do would be to incentivize less efficient litigation by individual actions, and you'd actually increase the actual fees that are paid, because if you assume that one of these small cases costs $4,000, even if you brought half of the class, 3,000 cases, you're talking about a $12 million fee here. Right now, we're at about $3 million in this case, and there may be some more to come, But when the district is in compliance with the consent decree, that's going to go away. So you're actually undermining the intent that the district suggests is the purpose of the statute. If you were to construe it to apply one cap to a class action. Your Honor, I'd really like to go back and argue law of the case, but you're not gonna let me. So Judge Williams, I'm completely with you, and I have been trying to figure out the best doctrine that this falls under. But I'm going to leave it alone, and I'm going to rest on the plain language of the statute. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, unless my colleagues have further questions, then thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the district in rebuttal.
Your Honor, if you accept the plain language reading that an attorney in a party means exactly what it says, then the result is the cap can be evaded every single time there's two attorneys in the case and every single time there's a parent and child party. You cannot reconcile awarding fees.
Go back to the class action that we actually have here. Would you say that the cap would apply based on how many different representatives of the class came in with their own attorney? In other words, assume this class action is brought by one member of the class with one attorney. You'd say the $4,000 cap applies even though it's a class action. But suppose it's brought by 10 named members of the class with 10 separate attorneys. Would that change it then to $40,000 cap?
I don't believe that's consistent with the district's position, although certainly
how
that is a more...
How would the cap apply if there were more than one named representative of the class? And each had their own attorney.
Your Honor, if you construe attorney and party to be the plural, then it's a $4,000 cap. If you construe it to
there was one attorney per party for 10, you would still say it's $4,000?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And again, to construe it in the singular...
If it's a class action. But if it were not a class action, if it were the consolidated case that Judge Williams was talking about, then would it be $4,000 or $40,000?
It would be $4,000, Your Honor.
Okay.
The whole singular plural thing isn't very helpful because we're talking about a statute that has three things in play, a lawyer, a party, and an action. And it works fine for a case that has that, follows that model. It requires massaging of some kind as soon as you deviate from that model.
And again, Your Honor, you look to congressional intent and Congress's intent.
I understand.
Okay, but again, I don't think the plainest reading of this.
You also understand that the statements of a single congressman are not adopted by both houses and signed by the president.
Absolutely, right? Your Honor, and I've noted that in my brief. I cited more for that proposition, an en banc decision from this court. But I also cited the committee reports, which
you
does
understand
support.
That the committee report, other than the part that's the language of the legislation, is not adopted by both houses and signed by the president.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Right?
I understand that, but it is instructive, I believe. And again, to reiterate simply, Congress could not have intended the cap to only apply where there was an attorney and a party.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. We should ask the reverse.
The case is submitted.